Welcome to Catholic Answers Live, the program where you participate with your questions about apologetics and evangelization, including the most important theological, spiritual, moral, and social issues facing the world today. Call now with your question for today's guest, toll-free 1-888-31-TRUTH. That's 888-318-7884. Now, from San Diego, Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Thank you for joining us for this hour. I am Cy Kellett, your host, and we'll discuss all kinds of issues in bioethics today. One of the most important areas of that in need of ethical clarity and moral clarity, in part because it's an area that's constantly changing, that's constantly breaking new ground. And so we need people who are prepared both in the sciences and in philosophy and theology to be able to help us to navigate these issues in bioethics. If you have questions about the beginning of life, issues having to do with the earliest stages of human life, the issues about the end of life, issues about disability, about all kinds of other things having to do with, well, now I guess editing embryos is now in the news this week. We're happy to take those calls, 888-318-7884. As a matter of fact, we would love it if you would call 888-318-7884. Our guest this hour could not be more prepared to discuss these things with us, I think. Father Tad Poholchik is a priest of the Diocese of Fall River, Massachusetts, and the director of education for the National Catholic Bioethics Center. He holds a doctorate in neuroscience from Yale University. Father Tad, thank you so much for being with us.
Well, great to be able to join you, Cy.
And you're coming to us from somewhere here in the West, I guess.
Yes, that's right. I'm traveling at the moment. Was in Oakland, California previously, and now in Tucson, Arizona.
And when I mentioned that editing embryos thing the other day, could you kind of explain to us, or what is that about? Are you clear on what it's about? Is the world clear on what it's about and what the implications of it are?
Yes, indeed. I mean, this is a remarkable development that has come to us out of Oregon Health and Science University. There's some researchers there who have been experimenting on human embryos. They were actually the same group of researchers who originally first cloned humans as embryos. That was back in around 2013 that they did that. And now what they have done and reported in the journal Nature is they have taken an individual who had a serious disease. It was actually a heart disease, such that it's something that affects athletes, where young athletes can suddenly have a heart attack due to a genetic problem that they have, and they can die suddenly. And they were able to create embryos that carried this problem, this heart attack problem, and then use a special genetic technique to engineer in and fix the bad DNA. And so what they did was they basically created 53 embryos, human embryos, by in vitro fertilization, and then some of them they attempted to fix this genetic problem as they created them, pretty much at the same time that they were creating the embryo. And they reported a high degree of success in that. And they, you know, basically allowed those multiple embryos to continue to grow for a couple of days. And then they killed all of them because you're not allowed to implant genetically modified human embryos into a woman's uterus. There's actually a law against that. And the FDA does not permit that to occur. So they killed all of the embryos that they had created.
So these
experiments... Oh, go ahead.
No, I'm just... it just baffles me that there's a law that you cannot implant a human being who's had some kind of gene editing, but you can create 53 human beings with the express understanding that none of them will survive your experiments.
Isn't that hard to fathom? I mean, that's the kind of world that we find ourselves in, a world of incredible contradictions and incredible immoral behaviors that are on some level not merely tolerated but perhaps even sanctioned by the scientific community that is so eager to forge ahead in these troubling new directions.
Disturbing indeed. What they learned from these experiments is meant to help human beings, like maybe a fetal human being could be, you know, helped with if that it was detected that this person had a disease or no?
The only way that this could really be applied would be pretty much as it was done. In other words, you have to do in vitro fertilization. You have to create an embryo artificially. And at the very time that you're doing this, you have to introduce this special gene editing apparatus. It's called CRISPR-Cas9. You have to introduce that at the same time that you're making the embryo. And then you would have to implant the embryo and hope that there aren't any what are called off-target mutations. This has been one of the concerns. They're thinking that as you make these corrections and fix one gene defect, is there a chance that you might introduce another new defect somewhere else in the DNA that you weren't quite aware of? And then this would be passed on to not only that embryo as he or she grew up, but all of his or her children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren. So, you know, you could go in there and make a real mess of things if you weren't careful. And so this is another reason that, you know, some of the scientists themselves insist on destroying the embryos, that they don't want to, in a sense, start the ball rolling in some direction that would then later come back and bite them. So it's a very troubling development on one level. These are experiments that could have easily been done in animal models. Yeah. There wasn't a need to jump right away to human embryos.
That's really kind of shocking, isn't it? Because you could have taken embryo, or even made embryos of say chimpanzees or something, and learned the same thing. So you didn't learn anything here that needed human lives to be wasted.
Yeah, that's correct. That's exactly correct. But human lives were wasted in the pursuit of particular investigative results. So this was about, you know, a quest for data, a quest for a publication, a quest for some renown and recognition. And it was done over the bodies of some innocent human beings who were created and discarded along the way. It really is just something that, you know, it's unconscionable, and there should be a greater outcry within the scientific community itself regarding these experiments. I mean, you know, at the moment, they weren't able to do these experiments using federal funds. They had to use private monies, which they were able to get a hold of on their own. But I'm convinced that...
Oh, well, we seem to have lost Father Tad for just a minute. We'll take a quick break.
Sorry, dude.
Father, we're having a little trouble with the signal. Let's take a break. We'll work on the tech end of it here. Nick will straighten that all out, and we'll be right back. If you have questions about bioethics for Father Tad, 888-318-7884 is the number, 888-31-TRUTH. I am Cy Kellett, your host, and we'll be right back with more Catholic Answers Live with Father Tad Poholcik right after this.
Stay with us for more Catholic Answers Live.
Hi, this is Cy Kellett, host of Catholic Answers Live, and I'm looking forward to meeting you this September 28th to 30th at our 4th annual National Apologetics Conference here in beautiful San Diego. This is one conference you are not going to want to miss. The theme is the reunion of all Christians, and we've got an all-star lineup of speakers guaranteed to fire you up. Catholic historian Steve Weidenkopf, apologist Mark Brumley, apologist Devin Rose, plus all your favorite Catholic Answers apologists. For almost four decades, Catholic Answers has has been engaging our separated brethren in charity to bring them to the fullness of the truth. Join us for a lively and inspiring conference designed to help you play an active part in the reunion of all Christians. This is where it all begins. Join us this September for a conference that is sure to ignite and inform your faith. Seats are available, but they're going fast. Visit CatholicAnswersConference.com or call 1-888-291-8000 today to register.
Homeschool Connections has recently formed a partnership featuring a dual enrollment program with Franciscan University of Steubenville. Our website is homeschoolconnections.com. We are a proud sponsor of Catholic Answers Live.
Wouldn't it be great to have a book to give to anyone to explain exactly why Catholics believe what we believe? The good news is that now there is. Why We're Catholic is the groundbreaking new resource by apologist Trent Horn. That one book you can hand to anyone as a starting point for helping them find their way into or back to the practice of the Catholic faith. Don't miss out on the most important, life-changing book to come along in years. Order your copies of Why We're Catholic today by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Pope Francis said, "All of us are called to mature in our work as evangelizers. We want to have better training, a deepening love, and a clear witness to the gospel." St. Paul Street Evangelization's online school of evangelization will equip you with the tools you need to be an effective evangelist. We'll ask for a pledge of financial support, but if you're unable to give, we'll set you up for free. Find out more and get involved today at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
Call now with your question, 888-318-7884. This is Catholic Answers Live.
We're discussing issues in bioethics with Father Tad Boholcek. Our number, 888-318-7884. When we went to the break, Father, we had a little technical glitch there, but you were talking about this destruction of embryonic human lives, 53 of them, in this scientific experiment that really didn't need to use embryonic humans. It could have used embryonic chimpanzees, one assumes, or something else. And you were starting to say something about the response of the scientific community to this experiment that used human embryos.
Yes, exactly. It seems that this is an area where there needs to be greater vigilance by the scientific community itself over these kinds of experiments. Now, it's true that the types of experiments that were reported, they couldn't use federal funds to carry them out, to create embryos and then destroy them. There are some limitations on that. So they had to go get private funds in order to do that, which they did. But I'm convinced that even in cases where researchers go and get private money and then do these morally troubling types of experiments, the scientific community needs to draw some lines and say, if you submit a research paper for review by us, we will not review this, you know, and just draw those lines clearly in the sand. That's the kind of stance that I think we need from within the scientific community. Otherwise, these rogue elements are able to get out there and, you know, gain attention and, in a sense, push the line here quite a bit further than it should be pushed.
Right. Well, Father, a whole bunch of questions for you, so shall we go to the phones?
Absolutely.
Don in Katy, Texas, watching on YouTube. Don, I suppose watching on YouTube. Are we on YouTube right now? I don't even... Don,
I was watching on YouTube.
Oh, you were watching on YouTube. All right, Don. Your question for Father Boholcek.
Yes, good evening, Father Tad and Cy. Thanks for taking my call. I was calling specifically to ask about the shingles vaccine, and specifically the Zostavax vaccine that's manufactured by Merck. It's my understanding that that vaccine has been manufactured from descendant cells of aborted fetuses, which makes it morally questionable. And I was looking at the National Catholic Bioethics Center's website, and on that site they quote, from the Pontifical Academy for Life, where they say that when the risk to public health outweighs the concern about the origin of the vaccine, it's okay to get the vaccine. And I guess what I was wondering about this one it seems like the risk to public health in this particular vaccine's case is a bit dubious, given that the shingles is not really that contagious. And I was wondering, is it morally acceptable to get this vaccine? And also, do you know anything about the status of the GlaxoSmithKline vaccine, which I understand does not use descendant cells, but is not yet approved in the U.S.?
Well, to kind of go backwards on your question, I don't know the current status of the GlaxoSmithKline vaccine that you reference. I know it's in development, and it's based on using yeast cells rather than using these cell lines that were derived from an abortion that happened, you know, 30 years ago or more. Hopefully that will become available, but I don't actually know the current status of that. That's the kind of question that I think would be best directed to, an immunologist or someone in the clinic who may be following the development of that more closely. But, I mean, your fundamental question is an ethical question, a moral question about whether it's the case that if we have a vaccine that has been produced in a cell line that uses, that was originally derived from an abortion, from a direct abortion, and the cells were basically harvested out of the corpse of the deceased fetus after the abortion happened, is it okay or not to use those cells? And you mentioned the Pontifical Academy for Life document. That document answers that question in a general way and says, well, there are concerns about, obviously, the issue of scandal, that we don't want people to think that we're getting soft on the importance of protecting human life if we use a vaccine like this that we know has this distant connection 30 years ago to an abortion, you know, that may have happened in another country. But it says that document stresses that in these circumstances that it is permissible to vaccinate oneself or one's children, but we should do this in general under protest. And what this means is that we should, you know, in some fashion contact the pharmaceutical company that has produced this using the problematic cell lines. In this case, the two cell lines, I think one of them is WI38, another one is called MRC5. And just to say, you know, look, it's not fair to us that the only option we seem to have available is to use your vaccine, which was produced using these troubling cell lines from this abortion that happened a long time ago. Please reformulate your vaccine. And, you know, to apply pressure. And people say, well, you know, I'm just one person. I don't have time to write an email or to make a phone call to these companies. Well, we need to do this. This is something that actually does end up having an effect. People take notice. And as more and more people do this, it kind of gains a certain tidal power, a change of tides that these companies do indeed take note of. So that was basically the conclusion of the Pontifical Academy for Life, that by vaccinating your child, you are not cooperating in abortion, because that abortion was over and done with a long time ago. It was done for other reasons. It was done for, you know, family planning reasons or whatever it was. And then this corpse was raided afterwards, and that certainly is not proper and should not have been done, because we should only use cells that are obtained when you have valid informed consent of the person donating the cells. And that was not obtained for these cell lines that were used to make vaccines. So there's a problem of consent here, of informed consent being violated. And it's obviously not something that we want to see continue into the future. So that's kind of the short answer on the ethical question. My hope is that the GlaxoSmithKline vaccine that you mentioned that's in development either is or will shortly be available to people who are looking to get an alternative to the Zostavax shingles vaccine.
John, thank you very, very much for that call. Lots of calls today, so we'll keep moving, and I hope that that was helpful to you. We go now to Mark in Kirchner, Ontario, listening on the Catholic Answers app. Mark, your question for Father Tad Boholczyk.
Hi, and thanks for taking my call. I guess my question is there a point at which genetic manipulation, particularly with embryonic cells, but you could, you know, in the future perhaps talk about adults, becomes so severe that it ends up destroying the person themselves, and they end up, and you end up with another person? And to use a bit of an imperfect analogy, you know, if you were to take kind of my brain, take it out of my body, put someone else's brain in my body, I would be dead, and somebody else would be inhabiting my body. At what point, if we do genetic manipulation, would that potentially happen? Is there kind of any thought on that? You know, if 99% of the genome, or does it have to be 100% of the genome, were replaced in, say, an embryo? Does it end up killing that person, and do you have a different person there?
Okay, Mark, that's a fascinating question, a question that I think touches a little bit on identity and ontology. You know, what kind of being are we, and what do you have to do to change the nature of our being? And this question actually already has been looked at in the sense that you've probably heard about in the news within the past couple of years the experiments on what are called three-parent embryos. And what they did there was they basically took one embryo that had some defects, some problems with the genetics of the mitochondria. These are the little batteries inside the cell. They kind of make energy for the cell. And there were some defects in the DNA there. So what they did was they took another embryo that had no genetic defects in the mitochondria, and they ripped out the nucleus, which contains most of the rest of the genetic elements, you know, your chromosomes. They ripped that out, and then they transferred, kind of like your brain experiment, they transferred the nucleus of the original embryo into the new embryo. And that way they created an embryo that did not have the disease associated with the mitochondria. So there's, you know, a very clear answer to that case. What you are doing is you are cannibalizing one embryo to get certain parts and transfer in other parts from another embryo, somewhat more essential parts, meaning the nucleus, which has the chromosomes and the DNA, and therefore creating a third brand new embryo that is different from either of the first two. And that's how they made some of these three-parent embryos that were in the news. So there is a point at which some of these modifications become very radical and become destructive, even in character, in terms of the original embryos that may have been utilized or cannibalized for parts to do the experiments. So I hope that's helpful.
Yeah, it is a bit, and I guess so. Kind of in that case, you had the original two embryos, and the nucleus of the one was replaced with the other. So basically, did you end up, in essence, because we believe that life does begin at conception, so in that case, did basically the one embryo, basically the one person die and the other person basically live, or was a third person created somehow there? I guess has some of that been worked out? And also with if you're just changing snippets of genes, for example, as well, has that kind of been worked out at all?
Well, certainly in those experiments, I think it would be fair to say that you had two embryos, both of whom ended up undergoing a destructive kind of transformation and don't exist anymore after the three-parent embryo is made. So you're basically sacrificing two embryos in order to create a third completely novel embryo out of the parts of the previous ones. So it's a little bit of a Frankensteinian project that goes on there. Now, you ask about smaller genetic elements and DNA at a smaller level. That question hasn't really been as clearly demarcated yet.
I suspect as our ability to maneuver larger segments of DNA becomes more facile for us, that that type of question will have to be looked at. For the moment, when you do genetic modifications, for the most part, you are looking at swapping out very, very tiny segments or stretches of DNA. And when you do that, you certainly don't change the identity of the individual. You are just changing some sub-properties that are, you know, quite far down the line in terms of the cascade of importance, and therefore, you know, don't represent any kind of change of identity in the way that these three-parent embryos actually do.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mark. Thanks very much for that call. You know, Father, it seems that we're in a state where the questions that maybe we never even thought we would be asking a few years ago, we have to ask with great seriousness now.
Absolutely. It's amazing where we find ourselves now.
We'll be right back with more Open Forum, Issues in Bioethics with Father Tad Poholcik, right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Catholic Answers Live.
Christian men, beware. With the idols of materialism, entertainment, and the flesh, it's plain to see that the world wants you for its own. Face it, it's tempting and easy to be a man of the world. Father Terence Ehrman has a challenge for you. Be a man of God instead. In his new book, Man of God, Lessons to Young Men About Life, Sex, Friendship, Vocation, and Loving with the Heart of Christ, Father Ehrman draws on his experiences counseling men who are struggling to live in the world but not be of the world. In a unique format, he offers a plan for ongoing conversion, holy spiritual direction for all men who want to master themselves and be transformed from within. Order your copy of Man of God today by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Wouldn't it be great to have a book to give to anyone to explain exactly why Catholics believe what we believe? The good news is now there is. Why We're Catholic is the groundbreaking new resource by apologist Trent Horn, that one book you can hand to anyone as a starting point for helping them find their way into or back to the practice of the Catholic faith. In a series of short, easy-to-read chapters, Trent covers the whole range of common topics, starting with why we believe in anything at all and answering all the common objections to the Catholic faith, both doctrinal and moral. Don't miss out on the most important, life-changing book to come along in years. Better yet, it's only $3 a copy when you order in bulk. Order your copies of Why We're Catholic today by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Colleen Kelly Mast.
I cannot even count the number of times that God has clearly shown me His power and love when I continue to say yes to Him. He provides for our needs. Even standing at the funeral home during the wake of my late son, the Holy Spirit kept singing in my head, "The joy of the Lord is my strength." I didn't feel very strong at the time, but I knew that God was holding me close.
Mast Appeal with Colleen Kelly Mast. Saturday, 9 a.m. Eastern on EWTN Radio.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Father Tad Poholcik, our guest this hour. Father Tad is a priest of the Diocese of Fall River. He's mostly known as the Director of Education for the National Catholic Bioethics Center. The National Catholic Bioethics Center, one of the most important institutions of thinking and learning and studying and proposing solutions and ideas in the American church today. I think lots and lots of people making use of its services and depending on it because it's reliable in coming up with answers that comport with the moral life and with the Gospels. We go now to we're taking all kinds of questions on issues in bioethics. So let's go to Colin in San Francisco, listening on Immaculate Heart Radio. Your question for Father Tad.
Hi, thanks for having me on. A quick point is that not all stem cells would be bad, even from your perspective. Induced pluripotent stem cells aren't derived from embryos. Similarly, CRISPR-Cas9 has applications other than editing of embryos that can have health benefits. So in dogs, they were able to use CRISPR to revert muscular dystrophy to healthy phenotype in adult dogs. So these are whole organisms that may have the same potential for humans. But with regard to embryos and fertilized eggs, my question is, what is the basis for valuing an embryo or a fertilized egg over another person? Like if you had a baby rolling down a hill that was going to fall off a cliff and a petri dish of fertilized eggs that were rolling, would you choose to save the petri dish of fertilized eggs or the baby? And for me, it would always be the baby.
All right. Well, Colin, good questions. And I think your observation at the beginning is a helpful one. We always emphasize to people at the National Catholic Bioethics Center that we want to support and encourage all of the morally acceptable uses of technology. So what you were implying is, in your statement up front was, well, stem cells, it seems like the church is opposed to everything there, but wait a minute, actually we're not. And you're absolutely correct, induced pluripotent stem cells, adult stem cells, umbilical cord derived stem cells. There are so many other sources of stem cells besides those that require you to target a human embryo and destroy him or her. And those should be the ones that we choose to push forward the frontiers of science. Similarly, you mentioned CRISPR-Cas9, which is this incredible molecular scissors that is being used in literally tens of thousands of different kinds of experiments where they are attempting to correct gene defects not only in embryos, but in all kinds of other tissues, organs, cell types, and animals. And you mentioned a few examples of it. Most of those uses would be what we would call morally licit, which means morally okay and don't raise the kind of controversy that we were mentioning at the start of the show that requires you to actually start fidgeting with human life in this destructive way and tinkering with it so that it ends up, you know, with effects that we're not sure what they will be downstream, and then you end up destroying the human subjects anyway. So your point is very well taken, and thank you for bringing it up. The second part of your question is a kind of thought experiment that you have put out here to try to suggest that really, you know, when you look at the matter here, people don't value embryos quite the same way that they value a full-grown adult person. Because, you know, look at this thought experiment. I mean, you mentioned one, I can mention another. You've got a clinic that does in vitro fertilization, and you've got a tank with 1,000 frozen embryos. And in the next room, there is a bed with an infant child lying in the bed in some kind of an incubator, having just been born. And suddenly there's a massive fire that flares up, and this whole clinic is going to be rapidly consumed. You happen to be down the hall as this fire is flaring, and you're going to run down the hallway, and you have the choice of 1,000 embryos or the one baby. And we might say that this baby is somehow related to you. Don't have to say that, but could say that. And the question becomes, oh, gee, I grabbed the baby and saved the baby, and I didn't save the 1,000 embryos. So that proves the embryos aren't worth anything. No, it doesn't. All that experiment does is play on what we are familiar with. It only prompts us to act in a way that we sort of recognize, oh, this is a child, this could be my child. We're not familiar with embryos, it's true. We're not supposed to be familiar with embryos. Embryos aren't even supposed to be in petri dishes or frozen in liquid nitrogen or stored in quantities of 1,000 in these cryogenic storage units. This is all totally unjust. It is placing them in an environment that is improper to them. And of course, we aren't familiar, so we react out of familiarity. Now, if you sit down and have a, you know, kind of intellectual reflective moment here, then of course we'll affirm that every one of those embryos in the freezer are of the same intrinsic value as the little baby lying on the gurney. There is no difference between them fundamentally, but one of them is definitely more familiar. We've seen baby faces, we've grown up, but we've held babies in our arms. Virtually none of us have ever seen an embryo except through these rare photographs that emanate out of research laboratory environments, and it looks pretty surreal and strange to us. So your experiment doesn't actually cast any light on the real value of embryos. It just plays on what it is we're familiar with and kind of, you know, tries to make hay out of that aspect of our lack of familiarity.
Colin?
Yeah, so I think we're still avoiding the argument for why we should value embryos over something that has a brain and has human experience. And I think there's a failure and more reasoning on your side in this case. So if you take St. Thomas Aquinas, he believed that an embryo didn't become human until many days after it was conceived. But he did say that abortion is a violation of the natural law. But those are two separate things. One is whether you're harming something that has value in its experience, and the other one is, are you violating a natural law? The second one is a religious argument, a fairly Christian one, and I don't think it should be imposed through law.
I don't think it's a specifically Christian one, Colin. The question of whether there's a difference in value between an embryo and somebody older who has a fully developed brain, as you put it, and, you know, other experiences that they've undergone. The question is only whether those two entities are different, and they're not. They are not fundamentally different. It is only the embryo that is capable of giving rise to those later states of individuals who have brain cells. You don't have the possibility of arriving at that state except through the embryo. So the embryo is precisely that kind of being who will, as long as he or she is not sliced or diced in the research laboratory, will elucidate a brain subsequently and will subsequently become a taxpayer as long as we provide all the appropriate conditions for him or her to do so and don't go in there and prevent him or her from exfoliating that full inward potential that characterizes their intrinsic being. So there is no fundamental difference between the two, and an attempt to argue that there are certain qualities or characteristics that should allow you to be given the grace of protection by society, those are backwards kinds of approaches here. It's those putative qualities exist precisely because of the underlying substratum that can give rise to those very qualities, and those underlying qualities are the humanness of the entity that you're starting with, and that extends all the way back to day one, the union of sperm and egg, and the formation of the first organism, the organismic integrity that is established in that moment. So there isn't any fundamental break here that one's going to be able to make hay on, and Aquinas didn't in any way step away from that paradigm. He was not aware of the biology, and based on a very limited biology that he had, he attempted to put this into a kind of framework or perspective that made sense. But if he were alive today, his position would be absolutely 100% clearly in the camp of what the church has taught now, without any ambiguity on this matter.
Colin, thank you very, very much for that call. Anybody else have questions on issues in bioethics? 888-318-7884 is the number. Father, Thomas Aquinas didn't know what we know because of the science of embryology, but that doesn't change the moral teaching. He always stood against attacks on innocent human lives. As a matter of fact, most of the clearest teachings we have about that are from Thomas Aquinas. But that's
correct. And I mean, he was looking at some, you know, complex and speculative elements of ensoulment, the question of when the soul might or might not be infused into the embryo. But at the end of the day, that doesn't affect the question of whether with the embryo at an early time point, don't you already have something that is uniquely prepared to receive that soul from the hand of Almighty God? And that would be, you know, the key kind of element, the recognition of the substrate of the reality of the humanness of who we are talking about here. That doesn't change. And the question of when God might or might not infuse the human soul, as interesting as it is, as theologically exciting as it is to, you know, talk about it, it doesn't affect the question of the viability of human beings. We are inviolable as soon as we are constituted. And the question of whether, you know, God later or not infuses the soul does not change that fundamental moral demand that all of us are under to safeguard fellow human beings at their earliest and vulnerable time point.
We'll take a quick break. 888-318-7884 is our number. The lines are pretty full, Father, and I want everyone to have a chance to ask their question of you, but I'm hoping I'll have a moment to ask you about Charlie Gard. You're the one guy I would like to know his view on the whole Charlie Gard situation. We'll be right back with more after this with Father Tad Poholcik on Catholic Answers Live.
We're ready and waiting for your call today on Catholic Answers Live. Christian men, beware. With the idols of materialism, entertainment, and the flesh, it's plain to see that the world wants you for its own. Face it, it's tempting and easy to be a man of the world. Father Terence Ehrman has a challenge for you. Be a man of God instead. In his new book, Man of God, Lessons to Young Men About Life, Sex, Friendship, Vocation, and Loving with the Heart of Christ, Father Ehrman draws on his experiences counseling men who are struggling to live in the world, but not be of the world. In a unique format, he offers a plan for ongoing conversion, holy spiritual direction for all men who want to master themselves and be transformed from within. Order your copy of Man of God today by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
The Catholic Answers Minute. I'm Father Vincent Serpa. In Matthew 15:21, when a Canaanite woman asked Jesus to heal her daughter, he informed her that he was sent only to the lost sheep of Israel. She then did him homage and said, "Lord, help me." He replied, "It is not right to take the food of children and throw it to the dogs." She responded that even the dogs eat the scraps from the table. Typically, he couldn't resist such humility and replied, "Woman, great is your faith. Let it be done for you as you wish." Her daughter was healed immediately. Humility is the key to his Sacred Heart. When we approach him with humility and faith, we are not full of ourselves. What we usually don't realize is that we are already filled with him. The virtues of humility and faith are gifts we receive from no one other than him. It is the crosses that he puts in our lives that give us the opportunity to grow in such virtues. I'm Father Vincent Serpa for Catholic Answers, Catholic.com.
Call now with your question, 888-318-7884. This is Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Father Tad Poholcik here with us to talk about issues in bioethics. And Father, I really do want callers to get their questions into you, but could I just ask you this real quick, because I know people will want to know your view on it. What, if anything, was done wrong or could have been done in a better way in the Charlie Gard case?
Well, I think the fundamental problem there really was a problem of who was the appropriate decision maker. We had a situation where first it escalated to the ethics committee of the hospital and then the whole hospital administration, and then it was taken outside the confines of the hospital into the court system, and then it even went further. It went to the European Union courts. And these deliberations about what should be done and what kind of care should be provided, you know, it ended up being made by basically the wrong decision maker. In this case, there was no reason or grounds to withdraw the decision-making capacity from the parents. They should have been left in command there But this didn't happen. It was kind of wrested out of their hands, and it ended up in this completely oppositional stance between these various parties. So that really at the core of it was the issue with the Charlie Gard case. Now, there were some other ethical layers in terms of, well, would this highly experimental treatment maybe be helpful, you know, from the specialist in New York to help his rare mitochondrial disease that he had? Maybe yes, maybe no. There was, you know, back and forth on that. And ethically, I think you could make a case that perhaps it would be worth giving it a shot. The expert said that there was between a 10 and 50% chance that it might help him. So, you know, those are not small numbers. If it is 50%, that's 1 in 2. And it seems fair to give the baby a chance, to give the child a chance with that. And there were other questions about, look, he's on a ventilator, and he's been on a ventilator a long time, and shouldn't that ventilator be seen as, you know, causing discomfort and extraordinary and heroic maybe, let's turn it off. That's what the hospital was pressuring to do. And again, the question that would be, first, is he really in great discomfort from this? His parents disputed that. They said, we don't have any evidence that Charlie is in pain. He seems to be tolerating all of this fairly well. He's just very, very groggy, low energy, because these mitochondria in his cells are not working right. They're not making the energy that they should be making. And he's failing, you know, in a kind of deep slumber. But no pain that we can tell, that we can discern. So, you know, those were some of the debates that were going on around the central issue of really who should be making the decisions, and it should have been the parents. If that had happened in this country, it would have been the parents. But in Britain, there's some strange provisions where these various institutions can get involved and take over the decision-making capabilities of the parents. And I hope that the Charlie Gard case will help the British people to go back to this and say, you know, is this really how we want things to be functioning in our hospitals and in our society? It doesn't seem like a reasonable way to provide health care.
And it does seem like the Pope's intervention and other interventions from high profile people were helpful in clarifying that this shouldn't just be done in a darkness where, you know, a parent can be overridden, but these things need to be discussed more openly. So that may well be a great gift that Charlie's life has left us, that people will have a sense that, no, these are not going to be just, you know, decisions made in a room where no one's going to be paying attention.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a great observation, and I hope that will be the net effect of Trump's intervention and the Pope's intervention, and just the fact that this got so much publicity. It was remarkable. It was almost a little bit like the Terri Schiavo case.
Right, right. Jerry in Melvine, Michigan, listening on Ave Maria Radio. You are on with Father Tad Poholchek. What's your question?
Hi, thank you for taking my call, guys. And Father, thank you for your priesthood. So this is kind of a question that might be not really bioethics in its essence, but to my understanding, when somebody takes substance XYZ, like alcohol, for instance, you know, if it impairs their faculties, now you're running into the area of, you know, grave matter and possible sin. And some of my friends who are Catholic, they seem to be getting into smoking marijuana and other things like that. So my question would be, is like, do we have any scientific evidence to understand, like, how marijuana affects us? Is it similar to alcohol? Like, is there a line with marijuana like there is with alcohol or not?
Well, I think the part of the moral analysis, really, of the alcohol case would be to say that when it's used at levels that are not actually impairing, that it also has certain positive effects. I mean, we would say, you know, people drink alcohol to be a little more sociable, to be a little bit slightly less inhibited. There are also some known health effects that are positive from red wine in terms of cardiac function, et cetera, so that there is at least a scenario here in which we can say, you know, alcohol does have legitimate uses when it's not at the impairing level. But I think it's hard to make that case for marijuana. I know some of the people who use it try to, but it appears that really doesn't hold. that one is talking about instead a situation where one is kind of actively trying to step outside of, you know, the given reality that you have, that this is a little bit more of an escape mechanism to get a high and to escape. And the question is, you know, humanly and morally, is that really an appropriate type of a response? Is this what we should be doing as humans, engaging in purposefully escape tactics like that, rather than maybe addressing whatever it is that's driving us at the beginning with all our troubles, you know, to resolve them more directly, more concretely, in a more healthy way than through escape tactics? So it's certainly the case that when you go above a level with alcohol, you can get into the same kinds of dynamics and impairment and so on, and escape mechanisms as well. But there is, I think, a stronger and really more reasonable argument here that alcohol can, in many cases, be used properly. But to the extent that it's not used properly, then you're right back in the same set of moral dilemmas that require then concerted action to make sure that one retains appropriate human freedom. So I hope that's helpful, Jerry.
Yep, it is. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Jerry. Appreciate that call. And what I'm happiest about that call is that our intern here who is taking the calls didn't know how to spell marijuana. I think that's good. That's a good sign for him.
That's good to hear.
Yeah, right. We don't want him to be too familiar with that. We go now to Anonymous in Utah, listening on 1010 AM. Anonymous, your question for Father Polchek.
Thank you for taking my call. My question is, is the Ava fertility bracelet accepted as a way to track fertility days for practicing Catholics to plan their families and to help them with infertility issues in their marriages?
Can you tell me specifically how the AVA bracelet works?
It's like a Fitbit. You put it on at night, and when you wake up in the morning, it'll tell you if you're fertile or not. And you can track, and it tracks pulse at rest and different other things, but it'll tell you if you're fertile that day or not. And then you just wear it night after night, and it tracks that for you. It'll tell you what days you are. So I'm thinking specifically of one young couple who have tried for 3 years to have a baby, and they're having infertility problems. They've done all kinds of tests and things, and they're thinking their next step is to do the test tube baby implantation thing. And I discovered this on the computer. I don't even know who sent this to me, but I was wondering, and they are a practicing Catholic couple, and I was wondering if this was acceptable or not.
Well, I have only a limited familiarity with this bracelet, and to the extent that it is set up to function, as you say, like a Fitbit type of thing, where it's monitoring real physiological parameters of a woman's body, like body temperature, pulse rate, and so on, there isn't going to be any fundamental moral problem with using this to acquire knowledge about your own body, including the state of fertility. The question becomes, when you have that good knowledge, what are you going to do with it? And you can do some problematic things with it, and you hinted at one in your question, which is, you know, oh, well, if I know that I'm fertile at a certain time, then I could go to the fertility clinic, and some of the embryos that we had them make last week for us, they could implant them because I'm now fertile based on this bracelet. Well, that raises clearly moral problems of its own, but not because of the bracelet, but because of a separate set of choices that an individual is making to do in vitro fertilization, to create life extracorporeally, and then to use this particular tool in that train of evil choices. But you could use a bracelet like this if a couple was struggling with infertility and they were saying, gee, well, you know, my cycles are irregular, and this is going to help me to know when the best time would be to have intercourse in the hopes of achieving a pregnancy. And that would be a perfectly licit, morally acceptable use of such information from a bracelet like this. So, you know, there's no kind of fundamental ethical problem with the bracelet itself. It's more, what are you going to do with the information that you get from it? So I hope that's helpful.
Thank you so much, Rita, for that call. We are at the end. Father, could we have your blessing before we go?
Yes, I would be happy to. May Almighty God bless you in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit. Amen.
Amen. Thank you so much, Father Tad, for being with us today.
Great to join you. Thank you as well.
Tomorrow, 2 hours of Open Forum. Jimmy Akin, 1 hour. Mark Brumley, another hour. Join us then. We'll see you then on Catholic Answers Live, God willing.